When I went into psychiatry in 1950, fortunately not knowing anything, but one of the conditions was, as part of my offer for the job, I would have to learn psychiatry, which is fair enough. 1950, we had no treatment for any of the major psychoses. The only treatment was to lock them up forever. We had no treatment.
We don't really understand at a deeper level that we are what we eat. And I usually say to people, you know, you look down at your dinner plate and what you see doesn't appear like the raw material for hair or skin or teeth or nails. But that's exactly what it is. We are just food recycling machines.
People don't take care of themselves for one reason or another, and they come to the doctor expecting to be kind of bailed out by taking a medicine, a chemical, in order to treat the disease.
I mean, if we look back at the last 30 years, Homo sapiens is in a really sorry state. There is no question that there has been an increase in mental health problems. And the World Health Organization say that mental health problems have become the major area of health concern.
Psychiatry is very much dominated by the pharmaceutical industry, especially at this time. In fact, almost all of medicine is dominated by pharmaceutical companies. There's virtually no emphasis on nutrition, on lifestyle, on any of those things. Everything is supposed to be solved by the use of psychotropic drugs.
When in 1950, we used to lock them up forever. In 2007, we lock them up with their drugs forever. There's no difference, except they may be worse off today because they're also being destroyed. Their body chemistry is being destroyed by the modern drugs, which didn't happen nearly so much with the old drugs.
I would say some of the worst things were sleepless nights. The visions of demons in my bedroom window when I tried to sleep. Just awful. Nightmares at their worst, as I remember. The hopelessness. I remember going through libraries looking for answers to mental illness, schizophrenia, madness, insanity, manias of all kinds. There were no answers.
So I can sort of remember my first session with Dr. Hoffer. It was very straightforward. He said, "Oh, you have schizophrenia." And I went, "I do?" And I actually had a name for what I had. And he said, "Do you hear voices?" "Well, yes, I do." "Nobody's ever asked me that before." I guess they were just such a part of me that I didn't realize that I had voices until Dr. Hoffer asked me that. You know, are people, you know, talking about you? And, "Well, yeah, I hear people talking about me all the time, and it makes me really nervous, and, it's hard to deal with."
In the past 60 years, psychiatry has made little progress in the treatment of mental illness. Some might say no progress at all. New pharmaceutical treatments are not very different from the chemical straitjackets of yesteryear. What other treatments are available? Not much, if you stick to the mainstream. Can there be a better way to help the mentally ill? This story is about a biochemical approach to schizophrenia, but it applies to every one of us. Can it be that our thoughts, moods, and behaviors depend upon what we've had to eat? Abram Hoffer was born a few miles south of Weyburn, Saskatchewan. By the time young Abram came along, the Hoffer family farm was doing very well. Abram, however, preferred schoolwork to farm work. In school, Abram studied the pellagra epidemic. Pellagra killed 100,000 Americans before its cause was discovered. It was caused by a deficiency of niacin, also known as vitamin B3. The U.S. government mandated the enrichment of flour with iron and B vitamins, which ended the pellagra epidemic in 1938. That was the same year Abram Hoffer got his Bachelor of Science degree and turned 21. He earned his Ph.D. in agricultural chemistry in 1944. He became a medical doctor in 1949. Abram Hoffer was made head of the psychiatric research branch for the province of Saskatchewan in 1950.
Psychiatry, by the way, is what you might call a dumping ground. Whenever a doctor ran across a patient who was either schizophrenic or depressed or bipolar or senile, they would then send him on to psychiatry, who would then put him into a mental hospital or to an institution. One of the main problems in mental hospital was that many of these patients were angry and excited and hostile. The poor people were terror-stricken, they were screaming, they were shouting. It was bedlam. Bedlam was a good term for any old mental hospital. There was really bedlam there. And the main thing was to give people barbiturates or sedatives to try and relax them a bit.
Antipsychotic or neuroleptic drugs were discovered in the 1950s. Chlorpromazine was the best known of these. These drugs spread like wildfire through the psychiatric community.
And these drugs settled them down very, very quickly. It's amazing. You get a screaming, shouting, crying patient, and 3 days later, he's blah. No, he wasn't any better, but he appeared to be better. He was socially a lot better. They couldn't think, they couldn't reason, they had no motivation, they were slobbering, sitting in front of their TV, they couldn't work. They were hopelessly ill people, and the only advantage was that they weren't running around on the streets crying. They were being locked up or kept at home, and no one knew about it. That was the situation of psychiatry. So we were put in charge of all the failures in medicine.
If psychiatrists have become a group that spend their time looking at symptoms, coming up with a label, and prescribing a drug. That's basically what they do at this point. It used to be, when I went through residency, there was a lot of emphasis on psychotherapy and trying to help people psychoanalytically or in psychotherapy. But the point is that psychiatrists really just don't even do that anymore. They basically are pill pushers for the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, to me, it's almost like a brainwashing of the medical profession, that this is the only way to do things. The pharmaceutical companies support the medical schools to a great extent. They support the journals. The first 50 pages of any important medical journal is taken up by advertisements for various medications, various drugs.
The large mental hospital at Weyburn was one of the two main mental hospitals in the province and one of Hoffer's chief responsibilities. When it was built in 1920, it was the largest building in the Commonwealth. Over half the patients at Weyburn were schizophrenic.
Dr. McCarricker, who was in charge of the whole unit, he was in charge of the psychiatric services branch. He was a very kind man. He also had the idea that the Quakers had in 1850. And this was that, first of all, you had to provide shelter. Secondly, you had to provide good food. Thirdly, you had to be kind and sympathetic. The Quakers in 1850 didn't believe in doctors or nurses. They would take insane people, up to 12, move them into a house without nurses or doctors. Their own people would run them. And they would hold them there. They'd be gentle to them, kind. They'd work with them. Every Saturday night, they'd have a party and a dance, and the staff would dance with the patients. It was really a very humane situation.
In fact, we had 2,000 seriously ill people and who obviously were in need of anything we could do.
Jeffrey Osmond was born in England in 1917. Osmond studied psychiatry while acting as an army surgeon during World War II. Later, with John Smithies, he had done some of the earliest scientific research with mescaline. They noted that its chemical compound was similar to adrenaline, and that mescaline's effects on perception were similar to schizophrenic symptoms. Osmond came to work at the Weyburn Mental Hospital in 1952. He introduced Aldous Huxley to mescaline, participated in a native Canadian peyote ceremony, and coined the term psychedelic while living in Weyburn.
We didn't feel that we wanted to make a great deal of money out of these things. We simply wanted to find things that would help people not get ill, which I, being rather out of date and old-fashioned, I felt was a good thing to do.
We are able to hold our world constant. For the schizophrenic person, this constancy breaks down, or begins to break down, which is worse because of the uncertainty.
Schizophrenia is characterized by abnormalities in the perception of reality. Distortions in perception may affect all the senses: sight, hearing, taste, smell, and touch. But it most commonly manifests as hallucinations and delusions, or disorganized speech and thinking.
You have a constant noise. Not always voices, at least for me. It was just noise. It was just like every noise is amplified. And so you just want quiet. You just want peace. You just want to make it stop. And there's no way of making it stop. You have voices telling you, you know, you're just so stupid and you're just lousy and you don't deserve to live and you should just go jump off that bridge, or, you know, why don't you slit your wrists? Or why don't you, you know, you're such a bad person. Just this all negative, 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 constantly on you.
Dr. Hoffer and Osmond originally hypothesized that there was a substance that was capable, that was found in schizophrenics, that could distort their reality and affect their brain. And they then isolated something called adrenochrome. They found that the adrenochrome could actually produce schizophrenic symptoms, could cause hallucinations, delusions, and so on. And adrenochrome is an oxidized product of adrenaline. And adrenaline often occurs when you're under stress. And people who have the genetics for it can then develop these oxidized stress hormones that are then capable of actually poisoning the person.
If you had the right genes, if you had the right genetic structure, now there's evidence for that, which would allow the conversion of too much adrenaline to adrenochrome, which was a hallucinogen in the brain, that if this happened, that this would act on the brain as if they had taken LSD, and they would then become psychotic.
With adrenochrome, your legs seem a very long way down. Your clothes may become uncomfortable. And particularly if you're convinced that something is wrong, almost intolerable. Small distortions can be even more frightening than large ones, because you can't be sure that they are distortions. And as tension mounts, so does one's uncertainty.
Ours is a simple, comprehensive hypothesis that wasn't based upon chance. We actually derived our hypotheses from very careful observation that had been made by Humphrey Osmond and John Smithies and myself. That was our hypothesis. Ours is the only rational hypothesis there is. The average psychiatrist will not answer your question. Ask him what causes schizophrenia. I don't know. They think it's biochemical. They use the word biochemical, but they don't understand what that means. Because when you load someone up with a toxic drug, you're not giving him a biochemical treatment. You're merely poisoning him. And it's easy enough to poison people, and that's no problem. So there are no theories that are acceptable except ours.
To offset the effects of adrenochrome, we turned to the cheapest, safest, and most easily available substance, niacin vitamin B.
We now, by that time, knew that niacin might protect the cell against the effect of adrenochrome. So I decided that we would try niacin.
It's 37 years since I was ill. I have recovered completely. I always think of my recovery as taking place in about 3 weeks, or 19 days to be exact. The theory that Dr. Hoffer has, that the adrenals produce this toxic adrenalutin, and that's like LSD in the body, that fits my story. And I think my own part in it was overdosing on sugar. I loved my sweets. I wasn't aware, I didn't really know that sugar can affect my mind. And he said, we'll put you on the niacin and watch what happens. And I didn't have any expectations, but something happened. I make recommendations for vitamins or supplements, always in terms of cleansing and building. And I make recommendations for diet.
It became mandatory for all my patients that they would all go on to niacin. I used drugs too. The vitamin didn't work fast enough and the drugs did, so the best solution was to combine them. So I'd start my patients on the drugs, which would help settle them down very quickly, help take away their anxiety, their hostility, their depression. Start them on vitamins. And we used the drugs as you would use a crutch for a person with a broken leg. As soon as the leg is mended, you throw away the crutch. As soon as our patients are mended, we throw away the drugs. And I think that's how they ought to be used. So that's why we get the recoveries that we see by the combination. This is what's called orthomolecular.
Two-time Nobel Prize-winning chemist Linus Pauling also championed the use of vitamins as treatment. Pauling coined the term orthomolecular medicine in 1968. The Greek ortho means correct, so orthomolecular means the right molecules in the right amounts.
The medical profession has been very hostile toward orthomolecular medicine, especially the psychiatric profession. It wasn't even aware of it, of course, until 1968 when Linus Pauling published his very famous paper in Science called Orthomolecular Psychiatry. Pauling never accepted anyone's word. He did his own thinking. You know, Pauling was the world's most famous scientist. He had a double Nobel Prize. One for his work with chemistry. In fact, his work in chemistry is the absolute basis of all modern medicine. He showed how molecules react with each other.
They started using nutrients to help people's heads, feed your heads, and lo and behold, their whole body got better because nutrients don't just feed the head. Nutrients feed the whole body. And when you feed the body and the body gets healthier, that feeds relationships. And if you feed relationships, then societies and cultures improve. And when they improve, nations stop warring. And when nations stop warring, then you can start taking care of the planet again. And so all of this begins with nutrition.
It's literally only 200 generations ago, we were all hunters and gatherers. We had no choice but to eat everything organic. Everything was whole. And we would eat seeds and fruits and vegetables. All the animals we ate were wild animals. A wild animal has maybe 5% of its body weight as fat. Most of the animals we eat today, even organic animals, you're looking at 20%. So food has phenomenally changed. And now that we know how our biology works in relation to food, it would be surprising if we hadn't changed how we think, how we feel, and our pattern of diseases, which clearly are escalating out of control.
The brain is very particularly dependent on nutrition because this organ is 2 pounds in weight and yet it consumes 20% of circulating oxygen, glucose, and other nutrients. And so, if you like, I describe the brain as a nutrient hog. It's using up 10 times more, it's 10 times more metabolically active. So where there's a shortfall in diet, and where that plate contains stripped down ersatz food, then of course the brain is going to be one of the first places that's affected. And now we can see from studies that particularly depriving the developing brain in utero of nutrients is leading to lifelong health problems, mental health and physical health.
One of the problems is the scale of food processing. And many people think in terms of grains and sugars and how they have been processed. There's an interesting historical element here in that the ancient Romans knew more about grain processing than people did up until the early part of the 20th century. That knowledge had been lost for almost two millennia. We've caught up, and we've probably superseded what the Romans had done in terms of not just refining grains, refining sugars, refining and creating all sorts of artificial fats. And most people, unless they are very mindful of what they are eating, are basically eating in this sea of junk food. The solution is really very simple, and I can't claim credit for the idea, but it's basically going back to fresh foods, avoiding almost anything that comes in a bottle, jar, can, or box.
These processed foods bring about inflammatory conditions, and these inflammatory conditions are associated with all of the problems that we have today, including psychiatric conditions, neurological conditions, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and so on.
I believe that the pharmaceutical companies do see nutrient therapy and the use of supplements and the whole orthomolecular approach as being a bit of a competitor, and so that's part of it. There's also a kind of orthodoxy or a belief in the medical school training that anything that has to do with nutrition is always going to border on quackery. Matter of fact, I was told during medical school, any doctor that prescribes a vitamin, by definition, is a quack.
One other thing I'd like to underline is that when we go through medical school, the first 2 years we learn a lot about anatomy and physiology and biochemistry. And then starting in the second year, we get to pharmacology. And what happens is that the attitude in medical school is that the physiology and biochemistry, well, that's we have to know that. But the real medicine is pharmacology. And that is the orientation of physicians. And what we are doing in orthomolecular psychiatry and orthomolecular medicine is we're going back to physiology and biochemistry rather than pharmacology. We assume that the body has the ability to heal itself if given half a chance. And the way that happens is by supplying the body with what it needs and trying to remove things that are toxic to it.
Most people don't understand schizophrenia. If a patient tells the psychiatrist that he or she is hearing voices, what does that mean? Unless the doctor has heard voices himself, it has no meaning. He can't visualize this happening. So we thought, first of all, if we're going to deal with schizophrenia, we have to understand its psychology. And we also said we will take hallucinogenic drugs like LSD and mescaline, and later on adrenochrome and adrenalutein, we will take these drugs and see what it does to us. Then we'll have a much better comprehension of what is happening to our patients.
We had to take this stuff ourselves to test its effect. We found that when it goes into the brain, it makes the brain less able to use its energy. After inhaling adrenalutin, Dr. Hoffer became suspicious of everyone. It took half an hour to choose between tea or coffee. Turned morose and thought he'd better give up his job.
This is so wonderful to see this long overdue Lifetime Achievement Award to my great lifetime hero. I mean, you really are Dr. Hoffer. And I guess I'm going to talk on behalf of all of us patients, and I have to try not to cry. So, I'm already starting. Because not only have you given us our lives, you were the voice all these years who said, you can get better, you will get better, take these simple steps, you won't be crippled by drug side effects. You've given us a quality of life that so many of us were told by the conventional psychiatric establishment was not possible for us. From the bottom of my heart, Dr. Hoffer, I send you love and gratitude and these tears. I love you very much.
In 1957, we first reported our findings, 1957. Until then, I was considered one of the top North American researchers, and that was because we never did anything important. We published a lot of papers, but they have no value. But as soon as we began to publish, we were getting results with NIAS, and you should have seen the world collapse about us. They said, oh my God, these guys are heretics.
And the mental health business, or the mental illness business, is a multi-billion dollar business. It generates profits that are in the stratosphere, obscene profits. So Dr. Hoffer and his work and the work of all these extraordinary doctors is an extraordinary threat to that industry. And I think in their greater and greater quest for bigger and bigger markets, because they've kind of got everyone in the States anyway, Prozac, half the population, they've now pushed it to the limit. Once you start damaging little children's brains, I think there's going to be a backlash.
Family from Carmel. Their 12-year-old son was schizophrenic. And his father, a doctor, called me and was crying. And I said, what's wrong? He said, my son, I've just been told by his psychiatrist that he will never get well, never get well. And so what? When he was given that horrible news, he began to spend as much time as he could in the library, and he ran across the first paper we ever published in 1957, where we first described the use of vitamins for the treatment of schizophrenia. I said, get hold of some niacin and talk to his doctor. Maybe he will agree to put him on it. And he said to the son's doctor, would you please try this niacin? Told him what he knew about it. The doctor was very annoyed, very hostile. And he immediately issued two lies. He said, first of all, it'll fry his brain. And then he said, a second lie, we have tried it, it doesn't work. If they had tried it and didn't work, why didn't they publish it? And there was never a single publication from them saying it didn't work. They never tried it. The idea of the Saskatchewan plan was to build hospitals that would be really good hospitals, where people would be held until they got well. They would keep patients even 3 to 6, 12 months if necessary. Then the drugs came along. They were so dramatic that psychiatry began to think, we don't need these hospitals. Their plan was not to really build a large number of smaller institutions where they could house them properly. Their plan was simply to put them all on drugs and discharge them. And for a while it was an enormous feather in your cap if the superintendent of a hospital could claim that he was emptying his hospital faster than you were. If you started off the hospital 2,000 patients and 5 years later you only had 1,000, that was kind of great news. And where did the 1,000 go? They went onto the streets. They went into terrible nursing homes. They went into terribly undesirable places.
Once you have schizophrenia, it's a life sentence. That's it. You're never going to change. You're probably maybe going to get worse. We just have to medicate you, and then you may be able to limp along on a somewhat normal existence, but totally medicated. And people don't like the medications. They have a lot of side effects, so they go off them.
Basically, what we're dealing with is a culture of life and a culture of death. And a culture of life is to try to supply the body with what it needs and to keep away toxic things. I think the culture of life is an orthomolecular approach. The culture of death is one that focuses on profits. And that's what motivates everything. So it's the financial situation that is motivating the development of the drugs and paying dividends to the stock holders and things like that. That's what's important. That's what drives things.
Of course, this is the future of medicine. I mean, it works. I mean, number one, it works. Number two, it's safe. So why aren't we all doing this? And I think the bottom line is it is money. The pharmaceutical industry have such a tight hold on medical training. So the average doctor just simply doesn't learn this stuff. And by the time they come out of medical school, they've got all this knowledge about how to diagnose diseases and which drugs to use and so on. And they've often been taught that particular nutrients, you know, just aren't effective, you know, sort of drug versus nutrient. But of course, this whole approach is not about, you know, a different kind of pill for an ill. It's actually an entirely different approach. And then when you couple that with the fact that you simply cannot do orthomolecular medicine in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, it really requires a much longer and more detailed involvement with the patient to really find out about their lifestyle. And also when you find out that, you know, it's relatively easy to get someone to take a pill, but to change a behavior as fundamental as eating, now that really takes a lot of work. So doctors are neither trained in the science of this, nor are they trained in the practice of how you would do it.
And now we are in the era of big pharma. We have huge companies that spend billions of dollars on research and investigation. The investigation is not really that hot because they don't do much original stuff. They allow much of the original stuff is done for them by university professors who don't get paid for it. So we are giving them free research personnel. But as soon as something seems to be valuable, they take out a patent on it and they make the money out of it. There's no profit today, and this sounds very cynical, there's no profit today in getting people well. Our society is based upon the fact that we have to have a certain proportion of people sick so that we can treat them. Hope. You can't live without hope. Suicide. High suicide rate with schizophrenics. High suicide rate with depressions. Very high. Very high. It's always due to the fact that they have been not given any hope. Their hope has been taken away. Because that's one of the most important therapeutic principles we have, hope.
It takes work to make it work, though. You can't just say, oh, you know, I'll take niacin, therefore I'll be better in 2 months. It's not the way it works. It's a subtle thing. You have to do the lifestyle as well as the vitamins. When you come out of it and you think, wow, that's amazing. How that could change. How that could change. It's amazing. You know, it's fantastic. So good old Dr. Hoffer, he knows what he's doing.
As soon as one is introduced to and learns anything about the science and the chemistry behind orthomolecular medicine, it's so much more logical than the notion of throwing synthetic chemicals on top of already existing chemical imbalances, that it's amazing.
I mean, really, as a species, we are not well. And whatever approach that, you know, we've been employing within medicine, it's clearly not delivering. And I think that all the fingers are pointing very, very strongly at our 21st century diet and lifestyle. And I do sincerely hope that governments particularly and the medical profession as a whole will stop being so blinkered, because these diseases are not going to be solved by some magic drug.
We need radical changes from the grassroots. Everybody, we all have to change in order to save our bodies, our earth, our universe, probably.
Science is a way of investigating phenomena. It doesn't really give us any final answers. It does give us many answers. It doesn't give us the final answer. We don't know anything, do we? Let's all think about it. How is it possible for the Earth to go around the Sun? We're millions of miles away. What's that fantastic attraction that keeps us from flying off into space? Well, we have laws. We have the laws of gravity. We have the laws of movement. Newton made those very clear. We have all these laws. We know that these things happen, but we don't understand why they happen. I think there is some kind of unity in the whole universe. How it came about, I don't have the slightest idea, but there is something. There is something called life force. This fantastic tenacity to living, which is hard to understand.
We've no padded cells here. We're here for the world to see. Our job is to press on with our search for the causes of mental illnesses, to apply our knowledge quickly as we go along. Our aim is to get as many long-stay patients out as possible, to keep new patients so briefly that they don't get cut off from family and society. Lastly, to keep them outside altogether. We look forward to a day, years away perhaps, when these great buildings will no longer be needed to house backlogs of long-stay patients.
And now we have a new paradigm, which is called vitamin S treatment. We initiated this whole megavitamin concept. Our work actually is the first in the world to create public attention to the fact that vitamins were therapeutic in themselves, that you could use them for a large number of conditions that were not considered vitamin deficiency diseases, and that you'd have to use them in the right concentration. There was no God didn't say you must only use thiamine in tiny milligrams. God said if you have thiamine, use it as you need it. If you're in vitamin C, use it as you need it. And that was the major thing. So I think that's going to revolutionize medicine, starting to do that now. It led to the orthomolecular treatment. It arose from the adrenochrome hypotheses. And as a result of this hypothesis, as a result of this paradigm change, we now have a treatment for schizophrenia, which is not perfect, but awful better, certainly a lot better than just using drugs. So I think I would hope that my major contribution one day will be that I was one of the pioneers in helping create the new vitamin S treatment paradigm. So I don't have the answer, but one day we're going to have the answers, and when we have, when orthomolecular medicine has taken over all of medicine, instead of spending billions of dollars examining one drug after another that's toxic, we will now start to look exactly at each particular disease and find out what are the needs for that particular disease. That's what's going to happen. The potatoes will contain a mixture of almost all the vitamins, but in very small amounts. But they are particularly lacking in the vitamin Bs. They don't have enough Bs. I already have 300 toxic compounds in my blood, so do you. We'll never ever live again in a pure free world unless humanity gets destroyed. And the best way to deal with the pollutant that we have already is to take lots of vitamins to act as a safety device. It helps the liver get rid of all these toxins.